Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army. Army officers say the missile, found sometime last week, has been inspected at Roswell, New Mexico, and sent to Wright Field, Ohio, for further inspection.
They were small, gray creatures with large heads.
They were small, gray creatures.
Creatures, large creatures.
Roswell, 60 years of cover-up. Hello, this is Jerry Pippin, and each night now, through the anniversary celebration in Roswell, we will either be broadcasting direct from Roswell or a show about Roswell. On this particular program, we are breaking new ground on the disclosure of the UFO crash. Later in the program, we will have movie producer-director David Sarita. He will be here, and he will be telling us about information he has that he says the Roswell UFO was actually shot down by a World War II fighter plane. More on that later. But first, the UFO community is talking about the Walter Haut affidavit released after his death. Haut is best known to us as a principal in the UFO Museum in Roswell. But most of our listeners probably know that he was the public information officer at Roswell Air Force Base when the crash occurred on July 3, 1947. I have asked our resident UFO expert, executive producer, partner, and webmaster Larry Dickin to come on the air with me. Larry has been checking about this affidavit, getting the full story, the background surrounding it, and also checking out the new information from other sources. We believe now we know the complete scenario surrounding the 60 years of the mystery. Larry, thanks for joining us tonight, and thanks for spending a few days doing the research, tracking all this down.
Hello, Jerry. How are you doing tonight?
Right off the bat, Larry, let me make it clear that Tom Carey and Don Schmidt put this affidavit in their book, Witness to Roswell, which came out in June, fresh off the press, as they say. In fact, it's selling so well, Amazon's already sold out, but they're reordering right now. And a lot of things in this book, and we'll get to the affidavit, but another thing is evidently Tom and Don have found two or three witnesses.
Well, actually, they have quite a few. And these are new witnesses. This is not a rehash book. This is all new stuff. Of course, they do give the background, but the way the book is written, according to Don, who I spoke with today, is that each chapter can sort of stand on its own as being a piece of the story. In other words, it's not all interwoven, and you're not going to get confused. It's going to be one witness at a time. You know, this whole story on Roswell, of course, all started back in 1947, and the basic thing that happened is apparently a UFO had some sort of an accident, or possibly somebody shot it down. We really don't know. Mr. Brazell, he made note of the fact that there was a thunderstorm that night, and that potentially lightning could have hit the craft. That's one of the theories, but you know, hey, lightning hits airplanes and they don't crash. I don't think a UFO is going to crash. But the thing is one thing, this storm, which incidentally no one else reported. And of course, Brazell lived in a very isolated area, far, far away from a town. And back in those days, they didn't have the radar for weather like we have now. And people really didn't know whether there was anything going on up there or not. So potentially there could have been a storm. However, there is another theory, and that is that often associated with UFOs sort of materializing out of nowhere, perhaps coming through a portal or something, Often associated with that is a formation of a cloud.
And there's lightning
and
strike
what if
stories?
That cloud was up there, and then this portal opened up, and out came the UFO, and there was a big flash of light. And then what if the UFO had some sort of problems with its propulsion system, and the occupants knew it, and it blew up? But three occupants managed to escape because they knew something was happening. They were trying to get out off of the thing. And that's a part of the story. We'll get into that in a little while as we discuss the affidavit.
Right, and in fairness, in that part of the country, just like here in Oklahoma where I am, it can be a severe thunderstorm 2 miles away and clear where you are. Yeah, when we talk about what Walter said in his affidavit, it's pretty interesting. There's some new ground there. And one of the, you know, one of the things is we all are familiar with General Ramey, who was in charge of that particular Army Air Force area or division. He was at Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth. But evidently, he got on a plane and took a night flight into Roswell because he was there in the morning when Walter showed up. And you'll get into that when you read the...
Yeah, and that's the whole thing about this whole cover-up. That apparently took place is the fact that, you know, a UFO crashed. You know, they had this crash object and some dead bodies on their hands, and everybody was fishing around about what are we going to do about this and how are we going to hide the fact that something occurred here, especially since we've got apparently alien bodies laying around. We've got to divert everybody's attention and come up with some kind of a story. And so that was what happened after they actually went out and recovered the materials, and they brought the bodies back. They brought the one craft that survived back, and we'll tell you about that craft in a little bit as well. It wasn't...
Now you not only talked to Stanton Friedman today, you talked to David Rudiak. And Don Smith.
Right, all three of them.
On the phone, in person. So you pretty well got a feel for this entire story.
I know when I spoke with Stanton, he told me that he was right in the middle of reading the book. He had not gotten to the affidavit itself, although he had glanced at it briefly out on Dave's site, actually. So he wasn't ready to do any comments about what he thought about it. He's going to reserve that for his interview with you in Roswell.
People are invited to come by for that. They'll be at the Civic Center. We have a live audience for those shows at the Civic Center. They tape every morning. I'd be there by 10 o'clock. It'll be a 90-minute show each day, but I'd be there by 10. We may not actually take till 10:15
right.
or so.
So I'm not going to give you any opinions from Stanton other than the fact that I did discuss this with
well,
him.
Well, yeah, we got you here because you've investigated this from several standpoints, and so you have a feel for the story.
Right. And he's, he will be... quote, giving his opinions to the whole world down there in Roswell, and you're going to be holding the microphone.
And basically, when you say that, this is fairly new stuff, and a lot of people were not aware this was happening at all. Now, some researchers knew about this. I mean, some actually had interviewed Walter and then agreed not to release the interviews.
Right.
In which he supposedly covered the stuff that was in the affidavit.
Yeah, we don't know how much he covered, whether he revealed all or not, but certainly...
Well, if they keep listening to our Roswell shows every day, we'll probably get to that. We're certainly going to try to dig it out.
And I gained a lot of information, of course, by talking to one of the authors of the book, and that's Don Schmidt. And, of course, he and Tom Carey are actually... actually bringing this out to the world with the permission of Walter's family. They were the ones who were the document was given to.
And Tom and Don will be on our show the 4th of July night at the Cover Up Cafe, and we'll have that show turned around the next day so people can listen to it on Thursday afternoon or evening.
Right, and Don has assured me that it's going to be open up the whole book and discuss all that you have time to discuss.
What do you want to do first, read the affidavit, or have you got something else you want to...
Well, I have some explanatory material here, and then we'll read the affidavit itself, which is not that long. So, you know, this is not like somebody wrote a book here describing everything in minute detail. It is quite short. It's less than a page long. So at any rate, I'm going to relate this story, and this is good background information that I've obtained with the agreement of David Rudiak from his website, and we will have a link to that so that you can go out and read the affidavit quite carefully yourself. Of course, we'd also recommend that you get all this other information, all this other new witness revelations by purchasing Don and Tom's book as well. And I'll have a link to that. So here's the story. Walter Hout was the public information officer at Roswell Base during the Roswell incident of July 1947. In interviews dating back to the 1980s, he said he was mostly out of the loop. His basic story was that on the morning of July 8th, Base Commander Colonel William Blanchard had dictated to him a press release that they had obtained a flying disc from a nearby ranch and were flying it on to, quote, higher headquarters. He said he thought the original press release was the truth, and he was convinced that the material recovered was some type of craft from outer space. Now, that particular statement is contained in another affidavit that he issued in 1993, and that's been previously published. If you want to read that, that's also out on David's site. He was pretty sure Blanchard must have seen the debris before issuing the press release, and said Blanchard would never make a mistake of confusing the recovered material with a weather balloon. Hout, who lived in Roswell, became one of the most interviewed and public Roswell witnesses and key advocate of a saucer crash, yet continued to disclaim personal knowledge of the debris or of the actual craft and recovered bodies as reported by other witnesses. However, this changed in 2000, and here comes what you were alluding to earlier. Hout gave a lengthy recorded oral history with researchers Wendy Connors and Dennis Balthizer. Of course, Dennis has been on our show many times.
Yeah, and Dennis is going to be on during the Roswell show. In fact, he's going to be on here this coming week, too.
Right.
And we've asked Dennis in a kidding way to come clean, but of course he may not be able to.
Right.
And Wendy lives in Albuquerque, and actually, first time I ever met her was when we were looking for the recording of that UFO that was fired on in Los Angeles in World War II.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she has the original CBS bulletin.
Right. Which is quite interesting. Quite interesting.
And naturally, we've asked Wendy if she can talk.
Right.
They have this interview. It's an audio. It's just too tantalizing not to stay after them.
Right. And we don't know what's on it. We don't know whether it's more than's in the affidavit or less or the same.
You're right. We don't. And we're going to pursue that. So go ahead. So we'll find out what's on that tape. Maybe we don't know what exactly is there, but we do have the affidavit.
So at any rate, he did at the time state that that interview also was not to be released until after his death. He died, I think, on December 17th, 2005. And, of course, not long after that, Tom and Don got to see the affidavit and examine it. And, of course, that was then transcribed and put into their book, which was just released here the first week of June. So, at any rate, we have in the interview itself, House first disclosed that he saw the craft in small bodies in one of the hangars there at the airbase. He also disclosed that General Roger Ramey, one of the architects of the weather balloon cover-up, had flown in for the staff morning meeting on July 8th and helped decide on how to deal with the situation. In December 2002, Hout filled out a notarized affidavit that was sealed and again not to be publicly disclosed until after his death. And Colonel Blanchard, a close friend of his during his entire life, made a point of taking him out there to see the object and the bodies. Hout also disclosed new information, such as personally handling the debris during the morning meeting, and he said, which he said was unlike anything he or anyone else there had ever seen before. Going out to one of the crash sites, probably the large Foster Ranch debris field, and bringing debris back to his office. He did that on his own. So he had some of the stuff in his possession at one point. He also revealed that the second main crash site with the object and the bodies was about 40 miles north of Roswell and had been found by civilians, you know, not the military, but, you know, crash occurred and civilians are roaming around out there in the countryside doing whatever they do. They discovered this, not the military, on July the 7th. Now, the crash actually occurred the night of July 3rd going into 4th. So that was rather strange that this incident occurred on our Independence Day.
Now there was an E.T. that was alive at that time, as Walter will lay out. Doesn't he mention that in the affidavit? Yeah. So that means it lived out there.
Confirm, you know, from an insider that actually was the case, and we'll get to that when we read the affidavit. He first became aware of both crash sites, you know, the debris field and the crash site of the small craft that contained three ETs. By the afternoon of Monday, July 7th, after returning to duty from the 4th of July weekend. A key topic of discussion at the morning meeting with the generals and the colonel was how to deal with the situation, since members of the press and public already knew something was going on. Hout gave insight into the reasoning behind Blanchard's perplexing flying disc press release, which Hout delivered to the local Roswell media. General Ramey wished to divert attention away from the more important craft and body site by acknowledging the remoter, less accessible debris site, but providing few details. Hout believed Ramey was acting under direction of his superiors at the Pentagon. It was discussed whether to tell the public the full truth, but this was decided against, and thus began a cover-up that continues to this day. Hout also mentioned being aware of teams sent out to both sites for months afterwards, to search for any remaining evidence. In other words, they didn't want one piece of metal or anything to be out there on those sites. This provided some corroboration for Bill Brazell's story, the son of rancher Mac Brazell, of having debris samples confiscated from him by such a team a few months later. So that's the background. Now here is the affidavit. This is dated December 26, 2002. Interestingly enough, not far away from the date that he died in 2005. My name is Walter G. Hout. I was born on June the 2nd, 1922. I am retired. In July 1947, I was stationed at Roswell Army Air Base in Roswell, New Mexico, serving as the base public information officer. I had spent the 4th of July weekend, Saturday the 5th and Sunday the 6th, at my private residence about 10 miles north of the base, which was located south of town. I was aware that someone had reported the remains of a downed vehicle by mid-morning after my return to duty at the base on Monday, July 7. I was aware that Major Jesse A. Marcel, head of intelligence, was sent by the base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, to investigate. By late in the afternoon that same day, I would learn that additional civilian reports came in regarding a second site just north of Roswell, specifically 40 miles north. I would spend the better part of the day attending to my regular duties, hearing little, if anything, more. This second site is the big revelation, the confirmation that there was indeed a crash site, and it wasn't that far away from Roswell, closer than many people thought. Brazell Ranch, or the ranch where Brazell worked, was some 65 to 75 miles north of Roswell. On Tuesday morning, July 8, I would attend the regularly scheduled staff meeting at 7:30 a.m. Besides Blanchard, Marcel, CIC, Captain Sheridan Cabot, Colonel James I. Hopkins, the operations officer, Lieutenant Colonel Ulysses S. Nero, the supply officer, and from Carswell Army Airfield in Fort Worth, Texas, Blanchard's boss, Brigadier General Roger Ramey, and his chief of staff, Colonel Thomas J. Dubose, were both also in attendance. The main topic of discussion was reported by Marcel and Cabot regarding an extensive debris field in Lincoln County, approximately 75 miles northwest of Roswell. So there's the 75. That's the right number. A preliminary briefing was provided by Blanchard about the second site, approximately 40 miles north of town. Samples of wreckage were passed around the table. It was unlike any material I had ever seen in my life. Pieces which resembled metal foil, paper thin yet extremely strong, and pieces with unusual markings along their length were handed from man to man, each voicing their opinion. No one was able to identify the crash debris. One of the main concerns discussed at the meeting was whether we should go public or not with the discovery. General Ramey proposed a plan, which I believe originated from his bosses at the Pentagon. Attention needed to be diverted from the more important site north of town by acknowledging the other location. Too many civilians were already involved, and the press was already informed. I was not completely informed how this would be accomplished. At approximately 9:30 a.m., Colonel Blanchard phoned my office and dictated a press release of having in our possession a flying disc coming from a ranch northwest of Roswell, and Marcel flying the material to higher headquarters. I was to deliver the news release to radio stations KGFL and KSWS and newspapers The Daily Record and The Morning Dispatch. By the time the news release hit the wire services, my office was inundated with phone calls from around the world. Messages stacked up on my desk, and rather than deal with the media concern, Colonel Blanchard suggested that I go home and, quote, hide out. Before leaving the base, Colonel Blanchard took me personally to Building 84, a.k.a. Hangar P-3, a B-29 hangar located on the east side of the tarmac. Upon first approaching the building, I observed that it was under heavy guard both outside and in. Once inside, I was permitted from a safe distance to first observe the object just recovered north of town. It was approximately 10 to 15 feet in length, not quite as wide, about 6 feet high, and more of an egg shape. Lighting was poor, but its surface did appear metallic. No windows, portholes, wings, tail section, or landing gear were visible. Also from a distance, I was able to see a couple of bodies under a canvas tarpaulin. Only the heads extended beyond the covering, and I was not able to make out any features. That's the reason he's like approximately 125 feet away from the bodies and the craft. The heads did appear larger than normal, and the contour of the canvas suggested the size of a 10-year-old child. At a later date in Blanchard's office, he would extend his arm about 4 feet above the floor to indicate the height. I was informed of a temporary morgue set up to accommodate the recovered bodies. I was informed that the wreckage was not hot, i.e. radioactive. Upon his return from Fort Worth, Major Marcel described to me taking pieces of the wreckage to General Ramey's office, and after returning from a map room, finding the remains of a weather balloon and radar kit substituted while he was out of the room. Marcel was very upset over this situation. We would not discuss it again. I would be allowed to make at least one visit to one of the recovery sites during the military cleanup. I would return to the base with some of the wreckage, which I would display in my office. I was aware of two separate teams that would return to each site months later for periodic searches for any remaining evidence. I am convinced that what I personally observed was some type of craft and its crew from outer space. I have not been paid or given anything of value to make this statement, and it is the truth to the best of my recollection. Signed, Walter G. Hout, December 26, 2002. That's it. Now, I have a close-out comment on this, because this is something that I talked to Don Schmidt about, which I've always had some confusion, and I think all the pieces are falling together, too. There have been so many reports about where the crash site actually were. I discussed this with Stanton Friedman as well, and there's some disagreement over, at least at this point, in his mind about where things occurred. But I think eventually everybody's going to come into confluence on this, and the story's going to fall into place. because the evidence seems now to be pretty overwhelming as to the exact location of everything that happened, you know, on July 3rd, that night. There is a debris field, of course, at the ranch that Mr. Brazell was in charge of, some 75 miles northwest of Roswell. And then there is the crash site itself, which is some 40 miles north of Roswell. And there are other eyewitness accounts that are in Tom and Don's book that basically confirm that some 2.5 miles from the debris field site, a number of ET bodies were discovered. In other words, if this craft exploded, and it was at a fairly low altitude, this was not like something that exploded up at 30,000 feet. This was, you know, less than 1,000 feet probably from the ground. So there were bodies found. They were, you know, not damaged to the point where you couldn't recognize them as being bodies. And they were also gathered up along with the bodies at the crash site. As I said, there were two bodies, and there's also eyewitness accounts of the fact that one of those ETs at the crash site was alive and subsequently was transported to Wright-Patterson Field in Ohio along with the debris and the dead bodies. So we have a much stronger story now, not only this affidavit from Walter Hout, but many other eyewitness accounts that are brand new and corroborate each other. And there's some really interesting stuff in the book. So we've got a bunch of dead ET bodies, which people were certainly not aware of before, and this indicates a much larger craft, and actually the craft at the crash site appears to be what amounts to an escape pod.
When we talk about all of this, been a lot of energy wasted over there at the ranch.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
The government did work.
Believe me, they, according to Hout's testimony, is for months on months, they went through these sites and made sure that there was not one piece of evidence left behind.
This is quite a thing that we're able to finally get what I really think this is probably pretty close to the 100% the whole truth and nothing but the truth story.
It would so appear, and as I said, there are so many new witnesses, you know, that you'll find in the book that bring up all these other details, including eyewitness reports from people that actually saw the dead bodies, and not just one person, but several people, apparently civilians, did see the dead bodies out there in the field, and as well as military personnel, and the fact that one of the ETs was definitely alive, and there's confirmation of that from several eyewitness military people. There were photographs taken, and that particular witness that took the photographs of the dead ETs inside a tent at the crash site was actually found by Stanton Friedman many years ago, and that appears in his book Crash at Corona. At the time, however, the man's name was not used, only his initials. In Tom and Don's book, the full name of the person is given, and I know when I was speaking to Dave Rudiak, we postulated that it was possible that the man had passed away, and now they were free to use.
Thank you, Larry, for bringing us up to date on this. Every day we'll probably have something new as the Roswell series unfolds.